Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Barbican Screen Talks. Hello and welcome to the latest in our series of Barbican Screen Talks. Every month we share enlightening conversations with some of the world's leading filmmakers and film fans, hand-selected from our archives. This month we bring you a wide-ranging discussion with one of British cinema's most wide-ranging talents. Lord Richard Attenborough, or Dickie as he was fondly known, was born in Cambridge in 1923. He trained at RADA and had a brief stint on the London stage before the war broke out. Seconded to the newly formed RAF film unit at Pinewood Studios, he soon undertook missions all over Europe, filming from the rear gunner's position. His commander at the RAF was Flight Lieutenant John Bolting, who went on to have a significant influence on Attenborough's career. Bolting gave young Dickie his first major film role in 1945's Journey Together, before 2 years later casting him as the stony-hearted gangster Pinky in the film adaptation of Graham Greene's novel Brighton Rock. That role would become emblematic of Attenborough's early screen career in the 40s and 50s, and a series of parts he memorably describes here as either little spivs or quivering psychopaths on the lower decks of Her Majesty's Navy. But Attenborough was not a man to be typecast. Over his 65-year screen career, he played a squadron leader in The Great Escape, a serial killer in 10 Willington Place, and a dinosaur zoo founder in Jurassic Park. In this conversation from 2004, Attenborough talks to Quentin Fork about working on Brighton Rock. He reveals what motivated him to move behind the lens, directing hits including Oh, What a Lovely War and Gandhi. And he shares fail-safe advice given by David Lean on the set of his very first feature, In Which We Serve. When Attenborough died in 2014, at the age of 90, he'd amassed an extraordinary range of cinematic experiences, both in Britain and Hollywood. And it's the benefit of all this filmic wisdom that you're about to hear. I'm Eleni Jones, and this is Barbican Screen Talks with Lord Richard Attenborough.
Well, what a nice welcome. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. You sat in the box briefly at the back, at the end of the film. Yes. What thoughts came flooding back after 57 years?
It was a bit over the top, I think. I tell you what is extraordinary, and I don't suppose I've seen it for 40 or 50 years, but the whole tempo of cinema has changed, hasn't it? Television has altered that, absolutely. There were moments where I always have thought that John Bolting, whose first picture really it was, apart from Journey Together, was a quite superb actor's director, insisting always on the truth to the greatest possible extent. And he believed, particularly at that time, that the cinema, the screen, had an opportunity of conveying the internal thoughts and attitudes and emotions, which of course you can't do on the stage at all in the same way. and that therefore the whole tempo of the sort of movies that he made, the sort of movies that Carol Reed made, and so on, were essentially cinema. But now with the tempo of television and the fact that you must cut, you must keep the cutting, you cannot hold concentration apparently for a long period of time, it seems slow to me. It seemed too measured, but I don't know whether it was or not.
I think it's your life passing before your very eyes, perhaps something that along those lines. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned stage, and of course, you'd actually first played Pinky on stage. I mean, I'm trying to imagine a stage version of Brighton Rock.
It was very bad. it was Graham, if my memory's right, and I read your book, looked at your book the other night, and I think you mentioned that he hated it. In fact, he didn't want me to play in the movie either.
So when the movie came along, I mean, in fact, it was bubbling up first as a different kind of film altogether. It was going to be Anthony Asquith as a Rattigan script and so on.
Correct.
And then the Boltings got involved, and they were absolutely desperate to have you involved. Yeah. Can you recall that period of when you were then cast for the film? Because it was some years after the play.
I was in the Air Force, and because I was in the Air Force, I was taken out of Flying Training Command just after I'd soloed for the first time. And I was posted to Pinewood Studios, where the RAF film unit were established. And I remember, if you were in Flying Training Command, you wore a little white flash in your cap, and you had to polish the bottoms of your shoes. And if an officer went by 20 yards away, you stood to attention and stuck up a salute. No, I mean, it was sort of madness before you actually got down to the reason you were in the Air Force. And I remember going to Pinewood, being told to report to the officer down that particular corridor, Flight Lieutenant Boltings. And I went and knocked on the door, and I went in. And out of the corner door of the bathroom came Flight Lieutenant Boltings doing up his flies. So that was my introduction to the Royal Air Force. but he had seen, it was because of that film called Journey Together that John decided that he thought I should play Brighton Rock. Mm. And he and Roy, his brother, were adamant, they never embroiled me in it. But Graham was, of course, deeply involved. In fact, the majority of the script was Graham's. Terry Rattigan wrote and John wrote a bit. But the concept, and that the end of the movie, of the record and so on, which great green aficionados said was an outrage and ruined his book and so on and so on and so on, was Graham's idea.
Was his own ending, which I don't know if people agree. I think it's a brilliant end. Yes. Was Green, I mean, were you aware of Green on and around the set when you were making the film?
No. He came to read-throughs, and I remember him coming on the set three or four times, but he didn't remain on the video. And he saw the film when it was completed, or I think he saw it when it was fine cut.
Well, Green, who notoriously kind of hated most of the film versions of his books, apart usually from the ones he'd been involved in adaptations himself, actually was very generous about you, and despite, after his reservations about you on stage, thought you were extremely good, I think is what he said.
He wrote me my favourite notice of all. People say to you, do you remember your notices? And you don't really very often remember your good notices, but you do remember certain notices. And there was a colleague of yours called Leonard Moseley, who wrote for The Express. And he, in reviewing the movie, said, and Richard Attenborough's Pinky is as close to Graham Greene's character in his book as Donald Duck is to Greta Garbo. So that is the one review that I have actually pinned up in my office. But Graham was sweetest, and I'm they're very egotistical, but I'm very proud of it. He just said, for Dickie, the perfect Pinky, affectionately, Graham. So I thought, well, that's all right.
So you mentioned that review, and one of the extraordinary things about the film was some of the some of the notices it got, not about the film itself, but about the kind of effect of the film. And
yes.
I must quote, because I think you might be amused to hear, this was the Daily Mirror, which I suppose was the sun of its time.
Yes.
A chap called Reg Whitley
yes.
wrote, "This was false, cheap, nasty sensationalism. Hollywood has banned the production of gangster films because they give a false impression of life in America. British film studios will have to consider doing the same. Brighton Rock will create abroad a similarly untrue picture of life in Britain. In all sincerity, I say we should produce no more like it. There are 92 minutes of murder, brutality, beating up." Gosh. "It's important that overseas shouldn't get the impression made by our recent films that we're a nation of toughs who rival in brutality the Chicago gangs in their heyday. Mr. Censor, please note."
Yes.
So, you know. But, in fact, referring to Green, you'd actually appeared in a Green film earlier, and a film which he actually did hate.
Yes.
Which was The Man Within, which was yes. his first published novel.
Yes.
And he didn't like it particularly because he felt it was an attack on his firstborn, is I think how he described it.
Yes.
Now, I presume that Green didn't come into your life at all during this. This was a much earlier film of yours, of course. Do you have any memories of The Man Within?
Some.
You were tortured in it, by the way.
Yes, I was. I was whipped by Michael Redgrave. I remember, and it was the first film I made when I came out of the Air Force, and we made it at Shepherd's Bush. It was certainly the first colour film to be made at Shepherd's Bush. I'm not sure whether it was the first colour film in the UK, but it was very, very early. Mm. And all the studios, of course, were rigged in a particular way. And because in those days colour demanded a tremendous amount of light, I mean, it was almost blinding in order to photograph with three-strip coloured film. We had to keep stopping because the heat generated by all these lights set off the sprinklers all the time. So we literally would go in and have to work for a couple of hours and then open all the doors and get some fresh air into the place before we could continue. Extraordinary. I always remember, I mustn't tell, nobody remembers Man Within, do they? No, good. If only you'd say it was the most dreadful film. And it was directed by a cameraman who was the sweetest of men, but had never directed in his life, and didn't know how to deal with actors at all. And I was scared sideways, and I remember very clearly having to play a love scene, which I'd never done before. He put me lying on a bed, and the leading lady had to come in and lie upon me, which was blush-making for me. I mean, I was so embarrassed, I didn't quite know what to do, but he said that we wouldn't rehearse, he said, because these sort of scenes did need great emotion and played for the first time, and therefore rehearsal would perhaps spoil it all. And so I lay on the bed like this, and the leading lady came on and lay on me, and I don't know how I got through the scene. And he said when it was over, he said, "Dickie, you looked in agony." I said, "I was." "Why?" he said. I said, "Well, I can't. Could you?" "Good heavens, it can't be true." "Yes, it's absolutely true." The leading lady, because she was not as fulsome as one might have hoped, apparently, in those days, had plaster of Paris breasts. So in agony was absolutely right. Now nobody's to go to the cast list.
Great story. One of the points of these occasions is that it's also, you do feel free to ask some questions. There is a gentleman, yes, waving now. Yes, please do ask. Right, I think that, I mean, that's more of a statement, I think, than a question.
I didn't hear it all, I'm afraid I'm deaf,
The crux of the statement, quote, question, was that he agreed with you about the pacing of the film. I disagree, because I think it rattles along. It's only 92 minutes, which, thank God, one wishes more films were like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to put words in your mouth.
Well, I mean, I really don't know, because I haven't seen it for decades. But I regret the increase of tempo that supposedly is now required. Gwent and I were talking on another matter for BAFTA and so on a few days ago, and he asked me the impossible question, as these writers do, what work do you like best that you've done? And I said that the film that I've directed that I feel least embarrassed by, or least worried by, was a film called Shadowlands with Tony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. I decided in that film that I really would not be forced into a tempo which I felt was unjustified in dealing with the depth of emotion and the revelation of characterization between those two actors. And they, in my opinion, were without fault. I thought they were miraculous in the film. And it's much slower. It's the tempo going back to early David. It's brief encounter tempo. And I think to have attempted to retain it in the current speed of cutting and so on would have wrecked that movie. Now, I don't know whether the majority of people will have found it slow or not, but I do think we have lost something in the cinema. There is something magical which nothing else can give you because of the wonderful atmosphere of coming into this black house with that light at the end there and total concentration, which is impossible in television. Because Granny's putting the cat out, or somebody wants another cup of tea, or whatever it is. So the degree of uninterrupted concentration is not almost impossible to achieve. But in the cinema it is, and I think it would be very sad if we lost this extraordinary opportunity of being able to say, I remember David Lean saying to me in which we serve, don't be worried that you haven't got any lines. In fact, the most effective shots in any movie is the reaction, not the playing of the line. And I think that cinema, if one can set its own tempo, has an opportunity of creating its own art form, which is not possible even in television, and certainly not possible in the theatre.
I mean, notwithstanding the accusations about its brutality and its viciousness, one of the, I thought, the most remarkable things is the fact that it was shot on location. I mean, 90%, I guess.
Yes.
Usually British films were shot in studios at a fairly funereal pace. Drawing room comedies tended to be the norm.
Yes.
And this was a very different kind of subject matter.
Yes.
Can you recall the filming of it at all?
Well, of course, it was very new to me, you see, Quentin, really. It was, as I say, the second film, I think, that I did after I came out of the Air Force. Before I went into the Air Force, I'd done a couple of films, both of which were simply dreadful, but in which we serve was marvellous to be in, despite the fact that if you blew your nose, you missed me. You know, it was a marvellous picture. But it was, as you very properly say, unthinkable that you shot stuff outside. Everything was created in the studios. In fact, next week I'm going to Canterbury because they've got a Michael Powell festival. And my wife, Sheila, played the lead in A Canterbury Tale. And that was the first close dialogue scene between Eric Portman and Sheila that was ever shot outside. I mean, that was illustrative of the point that you're making. Mm-hmm. And John Bolting, all the stuff on the race course and all the stuff in Brighton was shot, not on the race course, but in Brighton with hidden cameras. He put cameras in shop windows and so on and so on. All the first stuff at the beginning of the film, all that was shot. Well, and that was revolutionary. And of course, the Harry Waxman's lighting was so, because as you very rightly said, movies at that time were very often merely photographs of West End plays, farces sometime. And so if you were playing comedy, the one thing you do was to flood the screen with light. It's like you go to the theatre, you see a comedy. Any comedy is overlit because that is the way you convey the atmosphere and feeling and imagery to the audience. John allowed Harry to have black scenes where you could scarcely see what was going on, so that the light in the sequence in the set really did look as if it was generated purely by that candle or by that gas mantle. The reality of that lighting was revolutionary to a certain extent. And Harry Waxman was a terrific cameraman and created all sorts of new forms of lighting.
Another question over there. Yes, gentleman in the blue shirt.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Can you give us some, well, I mean, you've mentioned about the light, distinct memories of filming Brighton Rock. I mean, it's only 57 years ago, for heaven's sake.
To a certain extent, I was very, very apprehensive. John made me, and I'm sure it was a correct criticism of the play, I'm sure the play was ludicrously melodramatic. And John said there's no point in our making the film unless the audience believes, does not necessarily have sympathy, or maybe even just an iota of it, but believes Pinky. You have to believe that this poor, deformed, ravaged character, brought up in particular circumstances of living with his parents and watching them making love in the same room that he lived in, of this extraordinary Catholicism, devotion and so on, that unless you convince the audience of the truth of this character so that he is anything but a caricature, then the movie won't work. And so he constantly would reprimand me for playing scenes or lines to effect. I remember I played a particular line, and I played it very OTT, sort of whispered in a way. And he said, "Dick, look, I know perfectly well we've got microphones and everybody can hear you, but that is ridiculous. You wouldn't have said that line in that way at all." I remember him, and I was shattered. I was absolutely ashamed of what I'd done. I tell that story simply because somebody asks about the memory. And I remember being, I'd only made a movie with John before called Journey Together, again written by Terry Rattigan. And with the genius American actor, Edward G. Robinson. In fact, when Brighton Rock went to America, Edward G. Robinson's great part had been a picture called Scarface, and Brighton Rock was called Young Scarface in America. And I remember both Edward G. Robinson and John always said, "In the theater, you can get away with murder, and you are basically a theater actor, Dick. But in the cinema, if you are not true, if you are not absolutely believable, the movie doesn't work." And so what I remember most of all of that movie was a lesson, was a constant reprimand for departing from the credo of the truth in cinema. I remember Matt say something about Journey Together.
Yes. Yeah.
I remember playing in this picture and meeting this great man for the first time, Robinson. And in those days, you had to hit your marks on the stage absolutely precisely, to within an inch, because you were off your marks. Everything was taped, and the focus and the amount of light required necessitated your absolutely hitting your marks. And if you didn't hit your marks, then you just, the director cut the scene, you'd do it again. And Eddie would talk to me, and I would watch him doing this, and while he was talking about all sorts of things, no matter what it was, and he kept doing this all the time while we were talking about something else, totally. And I said, Eddie, what are you doing? And he said, well, Dick, don't you understand? With his American accent. Don't you understand? The truth in cinema acting is absolutely the prerequisite. You can only bring the truth if you bring absolute concentration. You cannot be thinking about anything else. I have to hit that mark, and I know I have to hit that mark. And if I don't hit that mark, the scene will be cut. But I mustn't be thinking for 1/100th of a second, I've got to hit that mark. It must be absolutely automatic to me, because if my mind is worrying about that mark, or worrying about my lines, or worrying about characterization, at a time when you are now performing that particular moment, that particular incident in that story, that person's life, the truth is gone. The camera will sort you out. It will find in your eyes that there isn't an absolute truth. And it was Edward G. Robinson and John Bolting who impressed that on me, I think, more than anything else in the cinema. And the things that I've tried to do in the cinema as an actor, I have tried always to find out the absolute fundamental truth of the characterization, because there isn't even time for characterization when you're shooting. You've got to do all that beforehand. All you do at that moment is to totally be convinced of that character that you know absolutely in your being under those circumstances. So nothing must interfere with that. That is why all this nonsense about having lines written down on bits of paper and so around the floor is rubbish. You can't manage it unless you happen to be a genius like Brando.
I mean, one of the interesting things that one of the questions asked earlier was he did mention in the same breath as Brighton Rock, he mentioned 10 Rillington Place.
Yeah.
And I mentioned your other epitome of evil,
yeah.
John Reginald Halliday Christie.
Yes.
Now, the fact is you haven't played many totally evil roles in your... No. And looking at you now, you can realise why. I mean, you know...
Grandpa,
Santa,
yes.
And Santa. Yeah. You know, so. But even earlier, no. But when you're playing epitomes of evil, how do you find that? I mean, that is... You're not going to say it's just acting. There has to be something beyond that, because you're having to do some pretty unspeakable things in this film.
Yes.
I mean, what was your motivation?
Well, I suppose to start with, if I'd been asked to play Christie, I'm not sure that I would have done, or I would have accepted it, because I found it almost the most unpleasant thing I've ever had to do. But I am passionately opposed to capital punishment. And there was a private member's bill going to go through the House, and Ludo Kennedy wrote a book about Christie, and a great editor called the Sunday Times editor, Harry Evans, was editing a provincial paper and took up this cause, and so did a couple of other people, and I'd made a film with a man called Dick Fleischer, who was a marvellous director. I played in a picture, silly picture, called Dr. Doolittle. And we got him over, and the picture was made virtually for nothing, because most people worked for nothing, in order to get this picture out, in case it might have had some impact upon the general public view of capital punishment. So I felt that somehow or another, I had got to find a credibility in playing a character which was almost incredible. And so I talked to a number of police surgeons, I talked to a number of psychiatrists who were responsible for dealing with him when he finally was arrested and so on, and I talked to people who had studied and written on subject matter, Now, an actor works basically on in three ways. He either works simply because what is presented on the page is what he does and it's straightforward and he doesn't have much to add to that. Or he works on his instinct and brings to certain characterizations elements which do not necessarily have any rationale, have any logic to them. It really is intuitive. Or he works from research. And I found that in talking about this man, I've almost found a pity for him. I almost thought, what in God's name, on this earth, in what we call a civilized society, what has driven this man? What, in sexual perversion, what has dominated this man to this extent? What circumstances were there? And so I tried to find in my research what might have brought about this extraordinary thing. In other words, a total sexual disaster in his youth and so on and so on and so on. But that on top of that, I had to find what you're referring to, which is this intuition, so that if you do lie on top of this girl and you are going to have a sexual assault on her, that there was something by the use of this gas thing that you put over her face, which gave him an ecstasy that you couldn't bring a logic to. Now, so there was no way of researching it. I couldn't find. So I had to use. Well, I suppose there was, yes. But I had to find something which was instinctive to me. So I had to find a justification at the back of my mind, almost, in the minutest extent as to what he did.
Well, you mentioned pity for Pinky.
Yeah.
And was that in a sense the same way? Because it's not all there on the page, and you therefore have to create that awful expression, your own backstory, to provide that's impetus for that evil.
Yes.
And is that the same, in a sense, process
as Christie those years later? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. My son Michael is a theatre director, and he's artistic director of the Almeida Theatre. And of all the grotesque things to be doing, he is directing, as of this moment, this is the commercial, is that all right?
Go for it.
Yeah, is directing a musical of Brighton Rock. And John Barry, who wanted to write the music, he always said, to the movie, finally, about a couple of years ago, wrote to Michael and said, I never did the movie, but I've written some music from the novel. And what Michael has done is, because he's basically a Shakespearean director, he has used the concept of Shakespearean soliloquy in this musical so that Pinky, whilst ostensibly finding a relationship which he finds distasteful with Rose, actually sings what he's thinking. It isn't like a normal musical, it's a play which uses music for soliloquy. And so, taking it out of Graham's book, from the show that Mick's done, you understand to a certain extent what has driven him to doing what he is now performing.
Time just for a couple more questions. Lady right in the corner here. Yes. The question was, at what stage of your career did you say, I think I've learned enough to direct, now I want to direct?
Oh, I didn't ever think that. I, with my friend Brian Forbes, who I bitterly, bitterly regret doesn't work now, hasn't made a movie for 15 or 16 years, but we decided that we were playing all the boring parts and we didn't want to go on playing, and I was playing either the little spiffs or quivering psychopaths on the lower decks of Her Majesty's Navy. And I really felt that... So we went into production and we made a film called The Angry Silence. We made it for £97,000. The only way we could do it was to... Everybody worked for nothing. And Kenny Moore was going to play the part that I eventually played in the movie, And about 10 days before we were due to start shooting, Kenny got a wonderful offer of a job where somebody was actually paying him some money. And so he had to do that, and I played in Angry Silence. But I hadn't intended to. I intended just to produce it. Because then we did the next film, which you mentioned earlier this evening, Whistle Down the Wind, which we produced. Then L-Shaped Room and so on, and Sails on a Wet Afternoon. And I was happy as a sandboy, producing and acting. I loved that. I found I had creative input on both sides, and I got tremendous satisfaction from it. And then one day, somebody offered me or showed me a biography of Mahatma Gandhi. And I never thought of directing, but I read this biography, convinced that I would never understand it apart from anything else. And I came across a scene where Gandhi was in South Africa and he was walking down the pavement with another Indian, and towards him came two white South Africans. And as was expected of him, he stepped into the gutter to let the white South Africans go by. And after they'd gone by, he said to his colleague, he said, "You know, I am always amazed that men should feel themselves honored by the humiliation of their fellow human beings." I thought, my God, that man has made a statement which I find utterly devastating. He was 19. I thought, my God. And I remember I was abroad and I rang up you had to put coins in to the man who'd given me the book. He was an Indian civil servant. And I finished the book in about a day and a half, and I said, "Mr. Kothari," screaming down the phone, "Mr. Kothari, I can't understand why you've asked me. I've never directed a film. But Mr. Kothari, I think it's wonderful. I would be honored. I really would be over the moon to be allowed to direct your picture. And Mr. Kothari, I'll come back. Who else ought we to meet?" And he said, "Well, there's no one else." So I said, "Well, what do you mean, no one else, Mr. Kothari? This is your idea. You're a civil servant, you're not a filmmaker." "No, no, no, I know." "Oh, I see. Mr. Kothari, is there any money for the film?" "No money," he said. And it was true. And it took us 20 years to get the money. But why did I have to go on to that story? I know. Yeah. Therefore, I wanted suddenly to direct, which is the answer to your question. And I went to India in 1962 through an introduction from Lord Mountbatten, whose story in which we serve was a thing I was in. And I was then hooked. Nothing else was going to stop me. I was going to make this film. And one day I came home. I lived in Richmond, as I still do. And on the top of the hill, my great friend Johnny Mills lived. And Johnny left a script at home and said, "Dick, read this. I'd love you to be involved," or something worse to that effect. "Call me in the morning." Because he knew that I would read something. And then the script that he left for me was "Oh, What a Lovely War." And I rang him in the morning and I said, "God, Johnny, I've seen the play four times, twice in the East End and twice at Wyndham's. It's a brilliantly achieved piece of work for the cinema. Absolutely wonderful. I'll play anything you ask me. I don't give a what it is. Two lines, I'll be thrilled." "Oh, I do congratulate you." "He said, what are you talking about, Dick?" I said, "What do you mean?" "Well," he said, "we want you to direct it." I said, "Johnny, you're out of your mind. What do you mean? Well, you want to direct, don't you?" "Well," I said, "yes, I do. I want to direct Gandhi." He said, "Well, wouldn't you like to direct this?" And I was sort of totally taken aback. And I said, "Well, God Almighty, Johnny, I think it's one of the great pieces of writing. I really think it's a phenomenal piece of work and a very, very important piece of work. But it's a brand new as a movie and with music. I'd have to think about it." Well, he said, Len was Len Dayton. Len and I debated as to who we should get to direct it. And we decided that we had to go one way or the other. We either had to find somebody who was brand new, who knew nothing about it at all, but might do some exciting things, with whom we'd have to take a terrible risk because of his ignorance, or we'd have to go to somebody who really knew the job and could do something miraculous because we knew they could, and we decided on the former. So that's how I began doing Oh, What a Lovely War. Then I did
yes,
Young.
Probably finally, yes. Has your son Michael turned to you for advice as he puts together his musical version of?
He's a very wise young man. He scarcely mentioned it to me. Our profession is very difficult for families who find themselves in the same business. And Michael has ploughed his own furrow. He went out into the provinces, into Leeds and Birmingham and Watford and then Hampstead. And then he was the chief associate at the RSC at Stratford. And he did that on his own. In the programme, he doesn't even say who his parents are. I mean, he's absolutely alone. I am about as proud as any father could be, because his record at the Almeida during the year that he's been there has been absolutely bewildering. But he has never asked me to see anything until he was ready for me to see it. Then he did ask me, and I saw Brighton Rock last week, but that was the first time that he really discussed it with me. And we stayed up till 3 and 4 in the morning talking about it, and I did say what I thought, but I did it because he asked me. And for him to feel under any obligation whatsoever to have to ask me would be awful.
Alongside the music of Brighton Rock, there are actually also plans to remake Brighton Rock itself, the novel, but this time, I believe, set in Brighton Beach, New York. Now, I wonder if you felt, I mean, not that you've probably read the book for ages, but do you think the world is ready for another Brighton Rock on film 57 years after what I think is a pretty damn good movie?
I don't see the point of remaking it, quite honestly. I'm not in the main in favour of remakes. It seems to me a rather pathetic... you can say, oh, it's the admiration for the subject matter and so on, but in the main, I think there are so many things to do and so many subjects to make and such important stuff which has a contemporary ring or historical which has the contemporary relevance. I wouldn't have thought that was a very good idea. I passionately believe in the importance of the cinema, and that the cinema has something. It's not a great art form, but it is an art form. And unless an art form has some statement to make and has some attitude, it doesn't really work, I don't think. I accept absolutely that cinema, of necessity, is a popular medium. It is, as Chaplin created it originally when he first started, it is a mass audience medium, and for that I think is wonderful and unique. Television has taken over from that to a certain extent, but cinema still maintains its position, and therefore, because it's popular, it must find a mass audience in the main, and therefore there are X number of movies which I wouldn't wish to be involved in. I'm not wish to be part of the pornography of violence and so on that flows about all the time now, or indeed the very crude comedies, which I don't think are anything like as good and as exciting and wonderfully funny as the old comedies were. I don't like science fiction very much, but there are certain things that I do care about, and I can't write and I don't compose, and I make movies now, and the Lord, sweet Lord God, whoever he be, has allowed me to be alive at this time while the cinema exists. And that to me is unutterable magic, and I think that it's very important that there is time for the cry for compassion that I said the other day and the plea for tolerance, because if there isn't, I think we belittle the genius of the invention of the cinema.
Richard Attenborough.
Thanks for listening to this Barbican Screen Talk with Lord Richard Attenborough. you haven't subscribed to this podcast, please do so via Apple Podcasts or Acast, or visit barbican.org.uk/screentalksarchive. And we'd love to hear from you. You can find us on social media in all the usual places. Just look for @BarbicanCentre.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.